It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday. We have with us Jim McCormick in our Ames studio, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim. Glad to have you on board on this very active week in Washington.
Thanks, Ben. Happy to be here.
Rene Rocha is with us, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Rene, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Ben.
Later in the hour, we want to tackle some things that are non-Kavanaugh nomination, confirmation related. Yes, there is political news that is being overshadowed by the big political news, of course. We've heard in the last few days. We'll talk about some of that later in the hour. The trade war between the U.S. and China just keeps getting bigger. More immigrant children unaccounted for, a new congressional report out yesterday on that. And a summit, perhaps you didn't hear this, with all the other political news, a summit between the North and South Korean leader. Jim will have a few words about that later in the hour. But let's tackle head on what has been consuming a lot of air in Washington in the last few days. Yesterday, Christine Blasey Ford, who has accused Judge Brett Kavanaugh of assaulting her at a high school party more than 30 years ago, says she wants the FBI to investigate before she testifies. Now, these are accusations that Judge Kavanaugh categorically denies. Let's listen to Christine Blasey Ford's lawyer, Deborah Katz, speaking this morning on CBS News This Week.
She's willing to do what she needs to do. She is willing to hopefully tell her story in a manner that is a fair proceeding. Unfortunately, what we're already hearing this morning is that the Republicans intend to play hardball. They intend to grill her. This is not an exercise that is designed to get at the truth. This is an exercise that's designed to terrify somebody who's already been traumatized.
Okay, Republicans have signaled they would not be postponing the hearing scheduled for Monday. They would either hold it with or without Blasey or declare it unnecessary if she refuses to appear. Of course, Chuck Grassley, our U.S. Senator here in Iowa, chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee. He says he'll treat seriously the reports of sexual assault by the nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. Here's what he had to say about that testimony, should it happen.
I intend to be respectful. These are very worthwhile things for us. They're very necessary things for us to be looking into. And I hope my colleagues will be as respectful, too.
Okay, we have other voices to hear from Washington concerning this. But first of all, let's get the voices of our analysts. Jim McCormick, jump in here. Your thoughts as we've seen these accusations surface, first of all, anonymously, then we had the identity named on the weekend coming to light. What is your reaction to what we've seen over the last few days and the reaction of the party leadership?
Well, I think both positions have really been dug in here, and I'm not sure that we're going to see very much in the way of compromise. Certainly the Republicans and the president has said that they're not going to have a separate FBI investigation. And certainly Dr. Ford and her attorneys have now moved away from participating in the Monday hearing, at least at this juncture and in public session. I mean, what might be taken, of course, is, I think there's been an offer to also have in a separate session, not in a public forum, mm-hmm. where she could speak with the committee and provide her particular view and so on. I don't think there would be the kind of cross-examine which apparently the Republicans have been really, really committed to. My own guess in just reading about this is that we're likely to see on both sides some pretty hardball things here. And I think that they'll probably have some sort of a hearing on Monday with Judge Kavanaugh. And whether there's testimony by Dr. Ford or not, I think is still unclear. I think also the Republicans seem very determined to have a vote by next Wednesday. I mean, I think they've really made the decision that, this episode is going to be part of the fall election one way or the other, and they really want to get Judge Kavanaugh confirmed if they possibly can.
Now, in a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee, Blasey's lawyers says in the meantime, in just these few days since her name has become known, that she's been the target of, quote, vicious harassment and even death threats. This since her identity has been made public. Let's reach out to our listeners and have you join our conversation. What are your thoughts on how the accusations against Judge Brett Kavanaugh, the nominee to our court, our highest court, should be handled? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Renee Rocha, tell us your thoughts. Add to what Jim said there, or perhaps you see it differently.
Yeah, well, there's a couple different angles to think about here, and one is just the shrewd political calculation.
Mm-hmm.
The Democrats, especially the red state Democrats, were under a lot of pressure to perhaps support Judge Kavanaugh. Many of them had, in fact, supported Neil Gorsuch. And one of the things that the story does, regardless of their sort of true beliefs about, you know, the accuracy of Dr. Ford's allegations, is that at least provides some kind of political cover. It provides a reason, if not to vote against Judge Kavanaugh, but to at least delay the vote, mm-hmm. knowing that delaying the vote has the possibility to change the outcome. If, for example, the Democrats do take control of the Senate in the midterms, that's not the most probable outcome, but analysts give it perhaps a 1 in 3 chance of happening, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of analysts have suggested that, in fact, Democratic opposition has sort of cemented. It's given cover to perhaps individuals like Senator Heitkamp in North Dakota. But the question then is, what kind of pressure was it going to exact on Senator Collins, Senator Murkowski in Alaska, Senator Flake in Arizona? And Senator Flake, at least, has seemed to indicate that he will, in fact, support holding a vote relatively soon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think hopes that perhaps you would have some moderate Republicans sort of peel off and join a newly solidified group of Democratic senators appear to be waning, and that.
Okay, so we aren't seeing. So that is the thing to watch, what you're saying, Renee. Collins, Murkowski, Flake, any of these senators peeling off from the Republican line that this should not be delayed, and saying we would be in favor of a delay?
Correct. I mean, Senator Flake has said directly that he would proceed with the vote, especially if Dr. Ford did not appear before the committee on Monday. And we haven't had the exact sort of clarity from Senator Collins, but I think that the odds that the Republicans are going to join the Democrats now in providing that majority to delay the confirmation process is increasingly unlikely to happen.
Okay, let's hear some remarks from the president on this. Of course, he counts next to the tax cut, putting judges in the high court and other courts, the appeals court, the district courts, as one of his major accomplishments of his nearly first 2 years in office. In remarks this morning before he traveled to North Carolina, the president said Christine Blasey Ford should accept the Senate Judiciary Committee's invitation to testify on Monday.
I'd really want to see her. I really would want to see what she has to say. But I want to give it all the time they need. They've already given it time. They've delayed a major hearing. There's no more just about. Look, when I first decided to run, everybody said the single most important thing you do is a Supreme Court justice. Okay, we've all heard that many times about a president. I would say this. I think he's an extraordinary man. I think he's a man of great intellect, as I've been telling you, and he has an unblemished record. This is a very tough thing for him and his family, and we want to get it over with. At the same time, we want to give tremendous amounts of time. If she shows up, that would be wonderful. If she doesn't show up, that would be unfortunate.
Okay, another short clip from the president's meeting with reporters this morning. Let's listen on.
Look, if she shows up and makes a credible showing, that'll be very interesting, and we'll have to make a decision. But I can only say this. He is such an outstanding man. Very hard for me to imagine that anything happened.
Okay, the president displaying a lot of sympathy for Judge Kavanaugh. Jim McCormick, share some of your thoughts here. So are we entrenched on both sides,
I think so. And I would agree with what Renee said, that the possibility of some of these Republicans moving to the Democrats, I think, is probably unlikely. I did note that Senator Corker, who was one of the first to say, you know, she has to be heard, now he's speaking this morning, or at least maybe yesterday, saying that he wants the vote to go ahead. I think that's not insignificant. The other thing that, maybe there's been some news that I missed on this,
mm-hmm.
but Senator Murkowski has been remarkably silent over this episode, at least from what I'm seeing here. Certainly Senator Collins has been, but she also raised the question about why this was, you know, not taken up earlier. I mean, I think that's part of the equation here, that, you know, that Senator Feinstein had this information for quite a lengthy period of time before it was mm-hmm. suddenly put out in the public arena here.
You raised a point that was pointed out to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, the Democrat. He appeared on The View yesterday exactly on this point. I wanted to play a little clip from him. Let's listen. Schumer said the FBI should investigate the accusation. They should present a report to the Senate. And only then, he said, will the Senate proceed on his confirmation. Schumer responding to the criticism that this accusation came very late in the confirmation process after Kavanaugh underwent many hours of hearings. Here's what he had to say yesterday on The View about that.
Look, the FBI didn't know anything, and that's why they do something called a background check. Mm-hmm. And they thoroughly go over nominees for the Supreme Court. But they didn't know about this until the letter was filed by Senator Feinstein. I think it was last Friday. So they should reopen that background check.
Why did she sit on it for so long then? She had it in July.
Because Professor Ford asked her not to.
Yeah.
And you have to respect that.
You have to respect
that. I do.
Okay, so does that timeline make it any clearer, Jim, or was that what you were understanding as well?
Well, yeah, that was a timeline, but I'm not sure that maybe this reflects on the FBI in terms of their background check, if they hadn't been able to uncover this in terms of, you know, going back. I don't know how far they go back, but usually, you know, I've been interviewed by some of these officials, you know, for students or others that are going for security clearances and so on.
Mm.
And they really usually go back to, you know, where you've gone to school and so on. So, I mean, maybe the FBI missed it, you know, this incident.
Okay. A lot of our listeners want to chime in, give their opinions on this. 1-866-780-9100. Let's ask our listeners calling up to get right to the point. We have a number of views to hear. Bill is with us in Des Moines. Bill, tell us what's on your mind in this controversy.
Sure. Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity. Just for context, I am a survivor of child sexual abuse by Catholic priests, so I do know firsthand the experience that this woman, if this is true, what she alleges, what that feels like to be on the receiving end of an assault or an abuse experience. The Republicans in the Senate need to understand that what they're doing with this demand on her and creating these conditions that they're insisting on. First of all, Senator Grassley, his behavior in this, is disgusting and clueless as far as what it means to be an abuse survivor. But they are creating this dynamic of persons or a person with power and another person who is powerless or certainly less powerful and has to dance to their tune. If they will not allow an FBI investigation, I can tell you this country is filled with forensic psychologists that have extensive experience in dealing with abuse survivors, and they know how to question things. They know what the patterns are for a person coming forward, usually mm-hmm. late in life. For me, it was in my 40s, even though my abuse occurred when I was only 12. So they need to wake up and understand the dynamics of any kind of abuse experience to a young person and then accommodate that in their process. And if they don't do that, this is a serious injustice to this woman. Let it be heard, and if they won't let other witnesses come in, they need to talk to somebody who's an expert in the field who can tell them and decipher what all of these things mean in this. And this credibility dance that survivors have to go through, I understand why they have to go through it, because you don't want false accusations.
Exactly. Bill, I think we got your point. Thank you very much.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Your perspective from Des Moines, Bill calling in. We'll get to other callers when we return in the second half hour of Politics Wednesday. Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University, Rene Rocha of the University of Iowa. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. We're back with more of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, Rene Rocha, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Wednesdays, of course, we like to pick apart the latest on the political landscape. I tell you, these weeks rolling by one after another have huge political stories that we've been picking apart. Last week, Bob Woodward and his book, the revelations contained in his book. This week, it's, of course, the Kavanaugh revelation. We have Christine Blasey Ford. This is a 51-year-old California professor accusing Judge Brett Kavanaugh, the nominee to our high bench in the U.S. Supreme Court, making the accusation that he assaulted her at a high school party more than 30 years ago. She wants the FBI to investigate before she testifies. Kavanaugh has categorically denied her accusation. Didn't happen, he says. Now, Republicans have signaled they would not postpone the hearing that they've offered for Monday. They would hold it with or without Blasey or declare it unnecessary if she refuses to appear. We're getting comments from Renee and Jim. We're also going to our phones, since this is a topic that is has a lot of people talking, thinking about how the accusations against Judge Kavanaugh should be handled. Let's go to Eric in Burlington, moving through our callers a bit quicker since we're short on time, and we do have a lot of callers. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'll get right to it. You know, if we're to believe that if you're a fan of baseball, you have an opinion on, you know, the infield fly rule and so forth. The idea that this guy doesn't have a strong opinion about Roe v. Wade, I mean, he's handpicked. And what's happened here is this is the equivalent of us looking the other way so Wernher von Braun, after World War II, could build us rockets to get us to the moon. I mean, this is exactly what's happened. They're looking the other way. I don't care if this accusation is. I mean, I care if it's true or not. But what I'm saying is they don't care if it's even true. What they'll say is, well, what was she wearing that night? Mm-hmm. Well, he was drunk. I mean, there's no shame enough for them to try to get what they want by any means necessary.
Eric,
That's what I'm telling you.
So, yeah, okay, I got it. Right. This is cynical politics, Eric, that you're portraying there. Rennie, are we being naive to judge the actions and words by leaders of both parties as anything other than cynical politics?
Well, I think the caller brings up an interesting point when talking about the potential for overturning Roe. And that makes this accusation, I think, even a little bit more difficult for us to handle. We're going to have a Supreme Court that's going to make cases and make decisions that are going to transform the nature of reproductive rights in the U.S. Do we want a justice that's casting a tie-breaking vote in the situation to have these sort of allegations, especially when it's not as if Judge Kavanaugh is the only qualified jurist who could potentially sit on the court? There are many, many other highly qualified individuals who don't have the same history and don't have the same allegations and therefore might be able to rule on such cases without having questions about the sort of legitimacy of the outcome. And, you know, the court's an institution which is highly dependent on public perceptions of its fairness, and that's, that's its essence.
Yeah. Jim, do you worry there, too, that if we have this shadow cast over right from the start, that the decisions of the high court will be seen in a different light by many Americans?
Well, unfortunately, I think that's already occurred. I mean, the court has become also a divisive force in American politics. We've had a lot of 5-4 decisions, for example, and that has elicited comments on both sides of the aisle. So, I mean, obviously, this would be more of the same, and it's likely if it is a movement towards 5-4 decisions to further, the kind of polarize the American public.
Mm. Let's get some more views from our listeners. Patricia has been waiting in Cedar Falls. Please, Patricia, welcome to the program. Tell us what's on your mind.
Thank you very much. What is on my mind, I too am a rape survivor. I was raped when I was 15 in the late 1960s. Didn't confront my accuser till I was in my 40s. However, I did confront my accuser, and that's the point. I think it's dangerous to make allegations and then not be present when that person is questioned. I do find it amazing that they intend to go ahead without being present for questioning. And I find that the individual or her lawyer, I feel that it's wrong for them not to be present and to just let this go forward.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to hear about what happened to you, Patricia, but you are a person who, better than someone who hasn't had that awful experience, to imagine yourself in such a setting to explain what happened, right? I mean, you must have put yourself
right
there. Yeah.
I just believe it's wrong to make that accusation or allegation and then step back,
right,
as though you can besmirch someone, whether or not we don't know if it's true.
Right.
And to make the allegation and then just step back, I find that just reprehensible.
Okay. So
if it did
make the
happen,
allegation,
you
you're saying she should turn up on Monday.
Well, I believe either she or in the person of her attorney should.
Okay.
I think it's wrong to set that forth and then step back, because people's reputations are then questionable. I'm not saying, I don't know if it happened or didn't happen.
Right.
But it's wrong to set that out there, because many women, that's what the Me Too movement is about. But I think, and I'm not saying anything about that, I'm not for or against it, but I'm saying that's what has harmed women over the years. And in my case, I wasn't able to speak up in the late 60s. Women were victims at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You were questioned about what you were wearing, or did you lead them on? And unfortunately, that is the issue. You know, it's difficult to defend yourself, and that's what happened to many women over the years. And now, you know, we don't know. And if she's not there, either herself or her attorney, how can a man, any man, defend himself against nothing?
Okay. Patricia, we take your point from Cedar Falls. Thank you very much. Patricia leads us to a point that I wanted to talk about, too, because this takes us back, Renee and Jim, to Anita Hill, of course, mentioned in many contexts here. Anita Hill in 1991, her treatment during confirmation hearings of Judge Clarence Thomas. Jim, take us back there. Remind us of a little bit of what happened, perhaps, and how this is seen now in historical perspective.
Well, Anita Hill, you know, made these claims or charges, I guess is a better way to say it, that in fact the nominee had engaged in, I think it was in terms of making kind of sexual innuendos when she was working with him. Maybe you can.
Yep.
Refresh my own memory of how much further it
right.
went.
Right, this is a work situation, and I think innuendo and so forth here. But we also had, during the confirmation hearings, an all-male Senate panel casting doubt on Anita Hill's testimony, right?
Absolutely. Some severe cross-examination or commentary. I mean, Arlen Specter, I think, was the chair of the Judiciary Committee at the time was kind of led the charge here. Over her claims.
Let's hear a little bit from Anita Hill this morning. She was on Good Morning America. She talked about the sexual assault allegation that's been made against Brett Kavanaugh. She urged the Senate to push pause, take time to investigate the claims.
The American public really is expecting something more. The American public wants to know about what happened, and they want to know that the Senate takes this seriously. And moving forward on this at this pace, with this kind of sort of black hole of a process being foreseen by many of us, we are really under the impression that the Senate doesn't take this seriously and doesn't see this as part of their core responsibility to the confirmation process, to the court, and to the American public.
Okay. Anita Hill on Good Morning America today. Renee, talk about this, because we have different social cultural conventions from 1991. That's a key part of this discussion, isn't it?
It is. But, you know, the Senate committee, which investigated the Anita Hill allegations, was, like, you know, as you just pointed out, sort of this all-male committee. Now you have a situation in which you have a little bit more of a tension and a contrast, because you have a Republican side of the committee, which continues to be all male and all white, and now you have a relatively diverse Democratic side of that committee, which contains individuals of color and women, and in fact, a woman of color. And I think that'll create an even starker contrast between Republicans and Democrats if that hearing does indeed go on Monday. And the other issue I think one of the previous caller raised to talk about here is what exactly is sort of the burden of proof in this case?
Good point.
You know, is it and certainly, you know, there's a sort of presumption that maybe it should be something like a beyond a reasonable doubt. But Judge Kavanaugh isn't up for a criminal defense right now. The question is, you know, what is the burden of proof when you're considering someone to be on the Supreme Court? And is it something like a preponderance of evidence or even less than that?
If there were to be an FBI investigation, we could imagine, you know, there would be some results from an FBI investigation. Something 36 years ago, would we have evidence that was so persuasive as to land us in a different spot, Jim, where we say maybe it was this way, maybe it wasn't? Or, I don't know, Jim, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question is whether you could, you know, get some witnesses. You know, there's a lot of difficulty here, it seems to me, in identifying exactly what year it occurred and where it occurred here. I think that maybe the FBI people could at least ferret that out. They might be able to get some witnesses, because they obviously have the name of the, I think it's two different high schools, as I have read or inferred from what I read.
I think private prep schools, yeah.
Private prep schools, yes, thank you. And so they could obviously get to talk to some of the individuals involved and identify them and get their recollections. Although, you know, I mean, the problem is that recollections get a little bit foggy, you know, after that length of time. But, you know, these are dramatic events. So, you know, maybe that there would be, you know, some evidence that could be brought to bear on this. I think it would take a considerable length of time for such an investigation to really take place.
Mm-hmm. And then we're into the midterms.
That's right. Yeah.
And then the calculation there that perhaps the House, maybe more than the House, would be in control of the Democrats come January.
Yes, I mean, it would really be the Senate here in terms of, you know, the judicial nominee, that if there's a new nominee or even the same nominee. And so, that, you know, there's at least some probability, as Renee said, that perhaps the Democrats will gain control and displace the Republicans and in control of the Senate. After all, the margin right now is very narrow.
Okay. And we have 7 weeks before that important November midterm date. Let's leave this topic. We have other things to get to. We tend to have politics these days, one big thing after the next, but there are many other important things taking place, and we don't want to ignore them. I want to ask you this about this, Renee, congressional findings released yesterday. The Trump administration unable to account for the whereabouts of nearly 1,500 migrant children. These are children illegally entering the U.S. alone this year. They were placed with sponsors after leaving federal shelters. Tell us your thoughts on the problem, again, of missing children after this no-tolerance immigration policy.
Yeah, so this mirrors the previous story that was going around a couple of weeks ago, where there was about 1,400, missing migrant children, as they were called. But it's important to understand that we actually don't really have any idea what happened to these individuals. But that means that we don't know that something nefarious happened, but we also don't know that they're not actually being sort of well cared for by their sponsors either. There's a lot of reasons why the Department of Health and Human Services might have been unable to contact their sponsors. Their sponsors simply might have not responded to a phone call, right? That's like literally when they say they couldn't contact them, they mean we made a phone call. That phone call was not returned.
Right.
The sponsors could be intentionally not responding to HHS. You might imagine that if you have a child in your custody who is unauthorized and they're, for example, family members, not all those sponsors are strangers, you might intentionally be avoiding contact with the federal government. So there are some documented cases of these migrant children being placed with individuals, those individuals sort of exploiting their labor, for example. But the vast majority of individuals may actually not be in the sort of harm that I think we sometimes fear when we have this
speculation
story.
Here, yeah. That human traffickers would identify children not tied to anybody and take advantage of them, right?
Yeah, and I'm obviously very sympathetic to this particular, you know, to the cause and the plight of migrant children. But I also want to be, there's a lot of reasons to be concerned about this group, and this is perhaps not actually the story which creates the most amount of concern. There are stories about the quality of the detention centers, mm-hmm. and obviously forced separation was an incredibly traumatic event. Those are stories which sort of consume most of my worry and anxiety rather than the idea that HHS just simply had a hard time contacting, about 1,000 or 1,500 parents or sponsors.
Jim, in the remaining moments, let me ask you about the latest developments in the trade war between the U.S. and China. It seems to be just getting bigger and bigger, both sides announcing their broadest waves of tariffs.
Right.
Yet yesterday, the Chinese government saying it's going to impose tariffs on U.S. goods worth $60 billion. This on the heels of the Trump administration's announcement, it was hitting $200 billion worth of Chinese goods with new tariffs. So that's unequal. That's not a tit for tat here. The Chinese, according to reports, are running out of. Well, they're putting tariffs on all the goods they get from us now, and
it'll be pretty close for the U.S. as well, and on Chinese goods that are sold here that are exported. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about. The total amount of trade, at least in goods, is about $500 billion, a little over $500 billion. And the Trump administration has put, as of yesterday's announcement, $200 billion. And before that, I think the number was $60 billion. I got to get my billions right here.
Right.
So we're moving, we're edging up. And the amount of exports that the United States, sends to China is about $130 billion, at least what I looked at some 2017 data here, at least in terms of goods. So again, China's moving up, as you said, very much to the to kind of limit. I mean, for the both countries are really, really having this kind of standoff here in terms of increasing amount of tariffs that are being put into place. The question is, and I'm sure you're going to ask me this, is how long can this be sustained here?
Right.
I think the Americans will have much greater difficulty sustaining these kind of tariffs in place because not only has the American public come to rely upon these, if you will, cheaper goods from China in terms of meeting some of their daily needs and so on, but, there's been this whole effort by a whole series of manufacturers to put pressure on the Trump administration in terms of these tariffs. And I just don't think that the American public will be as tolerant, as maybe the Chinese government or the Chinese public, in terms of some of these tariffs that are being imposed. After
right.
all, if you just look at the size of the importation on the part of the United States, that is much more consequential than, say, the Chinese importation of American goods and looking elsewhere.
Right. And when we look at the political map from the 2016 election,
sure.
we look at red states,
yes.
blue states, and the parts in the states,
right.
We see that agriculture is particularly affected. Here's the U.S., the Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, Mike Nagy, talking yesterday on CNBC about the impact this trade war with China is having on Iowa farmers. In this particular interview, he was asked, if farmers are going to vote Republican in the upcoming midterm election, here's what he had to say.
Well, I mean, there's a lot that goes into that. I think issues that ultimately impact the economics of Iowa and impact farmers' pocketbooks will impact the politics. but it's not as simple as just this one issue. Farmers are encouraged by the tax reform. They're encouraged by progress on regulatory relief, and so there's more to it than just the trade picture, but it is an important issue that absolutely will impact their pocketbooks.
Okay, the Iowa Secretary of Agriculture there. So yes, it is a complicated picture. On this program, we've talked with farmers to see their reaction of how they are caught in the crosshairs of this trade war. Of course, we have that aid that hasn't been offered to farmers, right, Jim? But right. If this continues, that aid will not reimburse all the damage.
Well, yeah, I mean, because they're using the funds from the commodity credit that is available, and of course that would have to be reappropriated next year, mm-hmm. and that really is an effort to use that in part to open up new markets here. So, you know, that this is sort of a one-time arrangement, and I think, you know, the Trump administration is obviously counting on that this will spark some response on the part of the Chinese, and at least at this juncture, you know, talks have really been stalled, and even though the American negotiators have said, you know, that they're willing to meet with the Chinese as long as they're serious. There seems to be no movement on that. So, mm-hmm. again, I think the longevity is probably going to be on the Chinese side rather than on the American side.
Mm-hmm. We have less than a minute. I'd like you to address, if you could, Jim, with your thoughts on what happened yesterday, the summit between the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and the South Korean President Moon Jae-in. Sum up what happened and its significance.
Well, at one juncture, I think it's very significant. I mean, again, there was a reaffirmation that there would be an effort to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. There's going to be a visit for the first time ever of a North Korean leader to the South. At least that's the expectation. And they say they want to move towards total denuclearization. But, and this is the conditionality is that the Americans also make some movement as a gesture of further denuclearization on the part of the North Koreans. They're going to North Koreans are supposedly going to also destroy close down one of their sites here.
Okay. No doubt more chapters to come for you to analyze. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Rene Rocha of the University of Iowa. Thank you both for coming in and analyzing both politics domestic and abroad. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.